This is a CNA podcast.
I'm Lin Suling, and this is Heart of the Matter. It is Thursday, January 28, and we are 2 weeks away from Chinese New Year. 8 would have been a lucky number for many Chinese listeners, especially during this time. But for Singapore, that number has come to symbolize stricter COVID-19 measures announced by the multi-ministry task force last week. With a cap of 8 visitors a day to each house amid a slew of other restrictions, what's driving this move? And how do authorities plan to enforce them? Against the backdrop of mutated strains, high infection and death rates elsewhere around the world, are these new restrictions our new normal? And what do they hold when Singapore has one eye on big international events like Tennis Open and the World Economic Forum in May? Plus, how are our Facebook listeners reacting to the news? I'll read up some of your comments later, to stay tuned to our podcast. Now, in the studio with us to get at the heart of the matter are two distinguished guests in healthcare and infectious disease. Professor Su Li Yang, Vice Dean of Global Health at the Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health.
Hello, thanks for the opportunity to be here.
And David Macha, Professor of Health Services and Systems Research at Duke NUS Medical School.
Thank you for the invitation to be here. Thanks.
So David, we were just chatting before this podcast, and you had that story of the taxi driver who was anticipating Chinese New Year. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, it was an interesting conversation because I had first thought that he was going to tell me that people were going to be restraining themselves, and that they were going to restrain themselves because they were worried about transmission, and that they realized that, you know, these new rules were something that were important to follow. But his perspective was that two things. One was that people were going to probably go beyond the 8 visitors because this is such an important part of the year, and that they're going to do that in part because they feel that their house is private and that people are not going to be able to monitor them, so they're going to be able to do that. They were going to take a risk, was his perspective, which I found very intriguing.
Oh dear. Liang, just to bring you into this conversation, David has raised a very interesting point. When you think about enforcement of restrictions, you have safety ambassadors around Singapore. They can come up to you, and if you're a coffee shop in a public area in a shopping mall, and you're standing too close to the person next to you. But how do you think authorities would approach enforcement? What is the enforcement plan you think they might have in mind in terms of detecting, identifying, and protecting people against these breaches?
This is going to be like what Singapore authorities usually do. It's like you can't catch every illegal parking car, but you have to make examples of some of them, and quite publicly, which is what Singapore has done for COVID-19 rule breaches in the past year. So I think that's likely what they will do. Probably that will help to ensure that most people would adhere to these new regulations.
But it's impossible to detect these things because after all, they're in people's houses.
For condominiums, for instance, you could have the guards take down the detail. That would be tricky for people who flout the rules in condominiums. HDB flats is more challenging. But again, I suppose if your neighbor gets upset, there's too much of the low hay sound coming from the house, then there could be complaints and there could be investigations. At the end of the day, it is more the threat and what happens to the few who are caught that serves as a deterrent rather than trying to catch everybody who flouts the rules, I think.
It's only going to take a few transmissions that are going to really make the difference. Singapore has had such great success in reducing the number of infections that it's a bit of a tinderbox, that a few people getting infected and transmitting clusters, you could really get into trouble. So the backstop for this is the contact tracing and quarantining. Again, not a perfect mechanism, but Singapore has it down to a science, so it's as good as it could be in that sense.
But I just wanted to unpack what could be the considerations behind these restrictions. How much of it do you both think was preemptive because Chinese New Year, infamous since last year in Wuhan, and that led to many super spreader events? How much of it was preemptive? But how much of it also was looking at the global situation and Singapore's overall risk assessment of the situation here?
It's a matter of both. It's better to try to prevent as many transmissions as possible, given that this virus does cause a lot of asymptomatic infections. They are very hard to detect. Also, we see now the emergence of some of the new variants of the coronavirus, such as the UK or the Brazilian variants or the South African variants, which are more transmissible and can lead to more persons being infected if there were breaches. These two factors are important in determining why we have these new rules in place for Chinese New Year.
I think that it was preemptive and makes sense to be preemptive in that I think a lot of people have become a little bit lax in thinking about the risk in Singapore because the rates of infection have been so low. I think there's a general perception that it's just such a safe environment. And I mean, I don't know what your experience has been, but this past weekend I was walking along one of the walking paths and tons of people were not wearing masks, or they were wearing masks not over their noses or not over their mouths or whatever. They were just sort of sauntering. They weren't running or whatever, doing something, you know, vigorous. So they really needed to be wearing masks. So it got me thinking that there must be some general belief people are carrying with them that the environment has become safe. We need to really transmit the message that that's not true.
So the new restrictions are also, in a way, raising the alarm.
Yes.
Getting people to be alert.
I mean, this is absolutely a key moment, sort of a crucial moment for people to be careful. This is also a time when people have become lax. So I think we've got this tension going on that we've got to deal with. That was why you're hearing some of these fairly aggressive messages, you know, that it's going to be a really bad situation.
So, Liang, you mentioned the new variant, the UK variant, the B.1.1.7, of which there have been 3 cases in Singapore so far. How much of that do you think will shape our response going forward and will change how we look at COVID-19?
Quite a bit, judging on the experience from other countries, like in UK, obviously, and also in Brazil, in Manaus, and in South Africa, where these new variants have overwhelmed the health system and the measures they have set in place in many ways. I think particularly striking was Manaus, which announced earlier last year that it had achieved almost herd immunity, like close to 70% infected. But still, they were hit by this new variant that caused more infections that led to their hospitals being overwhelmed at this point in time.
Are you saying that it's reset the board?
When we think about herd immunity, we tend to think of a single number. But when the virus becomes more infective, then you need to infect more people or a greater percentage of people in order to achieve that same herd immunity.
So how much of that do you think will affect how we handle imported cases? Because the B.1.1.7 variant was brought in recently by a teenager who came from overseas, from the UK even. Are you confident that our slew of restrictions at the borders and travel are able to catch these things?
They will still catch the vast majority of all these cases. As we have seen from the recent news, they're never meant to catch every single case, because that would mean putting in restrictions so severe that nobody wants to come to Singapore, you know, like 4 weeks quarantine or something. So the virus biology hasn't changed that much in its incubation period. We should still catch the vast majority, even of these new variants.
So David, way in here, how do you square off this idea that, look, it's the number of imported cases that have been on the rise, and yet at the same time, number of local cases have stayed rather low. It's about 5 at the max, I think, and 0 for a couple of days. Whereas for imported cases, it's reached about 48, about the same high as of last year. And yet the restrictions that are slapped on are local.
So your question then is, should we be restricting more travel than restricting local movement? I mean, I think the policy here can really most directly focus on what people within the borders are doing. And I think that the restrictions at the border level are pretty high. I mean, the idea that people come in, they're getting tested, stay home notices and so on, and they're being retested. I mean, that's a pretty aggressive approach. It's very hard to imagine that we could be doing a lot more unless we were doing some other kinds of swabbing, which I won't talk about unless you ask the question that China's talking about.
Oh, but we're going to get into
that. We're going to get into that. Okay. But it's really hard to imagine something more aggressive that would be socially acceptable. We are at the limits almost of what you can do to keep these variants out of Singapore. And what that means is we're 90-something percent or 95, 98, 99 percent, but we're at a high level, we're not 100%. Mm. And because it's not 100%, and because we have this tinder of a relatively low rate of immunity in Singapore, that we really are potentially in trouble. It also speaks to the issue of how important rapid vaccination will be, because you don't get mutations unless you have transmission. And so we want to stop transmission. And once we stop transmission, we can deal with mutations. But then that actually, Lisa, gets into this issue of global transmission. But you were asking specifically about imported cases. We've done pretty much what we can do.
We'll get into vaccinations, but just want to throw the same question I did with you, Liang. How do you square that off, that desync between the number of cases that are rising are on the imported side, but the new restrictions that have been slapped on are on the local community?
I think it was Minister Wong that said that the number of people coming into Singapore hasn't increased.
Exactly. Right?
There was this concern that was raised and he addressed it rather robustly. I thought we have more cases simply because the countries where these people come from have a higher prevalence of infection. But at the same time, the restrictions have to be local, because what we're trying to prevent is a bigger and bigger clusters of cases, or more clusters of cases appearing in Singapore. And that's by doing things to ensure physical distancing, people wearing masks and good contact tracing and so on and so forth.
So if you both think that we can be reasonably confident that our measures against imported cases are quite there, you're confident that we can catch the vast majority of cases, then why is it that Singapore's vulnerability has increased? After all, Mr. Lawrence Wong said on Friday that compared to a month ago, Singapore's vulnerability has increased, the situation can escalate quickly. What do you see as increasing our vulnerability if those measures are robust?
To maybe wind back a bit, I don't speak for the government, of course, but I tend to think that the situation at the borders is not set in stone, meaning that if the situation worsens in particular countries, or if the behavior so far of the viral infections changes, then suddenly the number of people we let in or the length of the quarantine period may change, right? These things are not set in stone.
Okay, so there are a couple of uncertainties there, but I just want to press the point just a little bit more. Seeing that we are seeing only a couple of cases, a handful, zero community cases, why are we slapping these restrictions then? How do we know we're not erring on the side of overcaution?
Let's try this metaphor. I kind of alluded to it before, but, you know, thinking about it like a forest fire, you know, you've got a very dry forest, which is Singapore. You're going to have little embers that are coming over the border into Singapore. You're not going to be able to stop those embers. They're going to happen. You know, maybe a small number, you can minimize them, but you can't make them go to zero. What you can do is to minimize the chance that those embers are going to blossom into a forest fire. And that's, I think, what local controls have the opportunity potentially to do. So vaccination, social distancing, and so on, and very aggressive case finding and containment. I mean, those are the things that we can do.
And as David has mentioned, and as we have all seen with our own eyes, the situation is not the same now as compared to last year during phase one or phase two of reopening, right? There are more people at the malls. There's certainly more people walking around in the streets. Taxis and Grabs have now slapped on surcharges.
Does that make you nervous?
In a way, I think if the virus does get into Singapore, especially this new variant, then there's the potential to have more and more community clusters with the situation that we have now. So it's good to take a step back and to reinforce the need for all the different measures that will make us safe.
Right, something that you guys are saying, that there are rings of protection. And of course, one ring is protecting the local community from imported cases. But another ring also is to ensure that if it does get into the local community, then some distance, some vigilance would also help. The other ring that I think David mentioned is vaccination. Singapore has a pretty aggressive vaccination strategy to immunize our population by the third quarter of this year. And there have been steps over the last couple of weeks to vaccinate frontline workers, healthcare, air travel, even soldiers. But of course, experts have also said that vaccinations are not the silver bullet. Tell us how you would see vaccination fitting into Singapore's overall strategy to manage COVID-19, given the context that you've also mentioned about variants and the uncertainty around the world.
You mentioned rings, right? I think the analogy that's been used quite commonly is more like layers of Swiss cheese. They all have holes, but you make it such that the holes don't line up, or they shouldn't line up all the time. And if you view vaccinations as another layer of this Swiss cheese protection, then you can see how they all stack up. Because we know we're not going to achieve 100% or even 90% vaccination of the population, right? There'll be those who are not eligible. There are those who are still hesitant, and there are those who refuse outright. I think from all the different surveys that's done, they form about 20 or 30% of the population. So when you achieve 70% vaccination of those that are eligible, that still leaves a substantial proportion that could still be infected. It does not prevent all infections, but it may potentially limit the size of the clusters that form.
The primary goal of vaccination is to reduce the risk of developing infection, symptomatic infection, but particularly severe infection and fatality. Vaccination will accomplish that. And to the best of my understanding about these variants, there's at least reasonable suspicion that they will carry over to some of the variants, if not all the variants. So I think the vaccination as a way of reducing that, and then the primary goal originally has been to reduce the burden on the healthcare system. So the idea of this forest fire is not only that people would die and develop long-term complications of COVID, but that they would overwhelm the hospital system, the healthcare system. And that's one of the things that vaccination should be able to do.
I know you've mentioned we should be alert and vigilant, but I just want to get a bit greedy here. The question also is, when it comes to vaccination, if we reach a certain target of vaccinations or we reach a certain level of conditions that we're comfortable with, when can we relax some restrictions? Because that was also a point and a potential trade-off that Minister Lawrence Wong had alluded to in his interview a couple of weeks back with news outlets.
We all hope for that, but there are still some unknowns which hopefully will be known in a few months' time. One of it, which is whether the vaccine actually prevents severe disease or it actually prevents transmission of the virus.
Right, yeah.
Right. If it prevents transmission of the virus, then...
And the data is not out yet.
The data is not out yet. Yes, that's right.
Right.
So, but
yeah,
if all it does is to prevent severe disease, then I'm afraid we'll probably end up having quite a number of these restrictions still in place for the rest of this year easily.
So the other question that has cropped up is how does testing fit with this overall strategy, given that there have also been advances in the way that we test? And I think, David, you alluded to that when you talked about the news coming from China. Do you want to talk about that?
The notion is that if we can test, then you can identify people who are infected and then contain them and quarantine them. But the issue that's been known for a while is that people can test negative and still transmit because they're carrying the virus, say, in their GI tract. And so, you know, what I was alluding to before was this notion, I think it's going on in China, which is not being very well received, is doing anal swabs, which basically is taking advantage of the fact that the last place that you would expect to see the virus before it disappears would be at the end of the GI tract. People are not going to be very happy about that particular idea, but it would be a strategy for maximizing the chance that you've been able to tell that this individual, a particular individual, is not transmitting because they're not carrying the virus.
But wouldn't that be something in our suite when we consider there are many different kinds of tests, the rapid antigen test, there's the PCR test, we've got different levels of accuracy, and now we have one more to our armory. Wouldn't that help?
This anal test is not a different test. It's just a different site of testing.
It's just a different thing.
They're still doing PCR on the samples that they collect, whether it's from the nose or from the backside.
Is there an ideal system that will let us get to a stage where we can, I'm being greedy here again, peel back restrictions? Because after all, I think about how last year Paul Krugman had talked about this ideal state of testing, that if you test every 2 weeks, I think he said, or 1 week even, you can actually get to a stage where the economy can open up, restrictions can be rolled back. But now, of course, it's been many months since then. Can I get your take on that?
What you're getting at is you're not going to get to perfection, which is zero infections and zero deaths and so on and so forth. What you're going to get in is a balance and a point of stability where it's socially tolerable. And I think that that's when you feel the economy is going to be able to be open, is when you've struck that balance. We can reach that balance, assuming, of course, that we don't get some terrible variant and so on. We've done that with influenza. I mean, it's not exactly influenza, but there's a lot of similarities. We tolerate the fact that there are excess numbers of deaths due to influenza. It's just the way that we live with that. So at some point, we do have to make a social decision, which is, when have we reached the level of tolerability?
I think what you propose is interesting, but it's challenging, and it's challenging for me to explain. It's because of the different properties of these tests. When people think about tests, they just think about finding the virus for this particular test. But these tests also have false positives. That is, the test may not be so specific. So even if the test, for instance, has a specificity that's 99.9%, which is what the PCR tests are about, then 1 in 1,000 of these will be a false positive, and that person will be inconvenienced greatly because he'll be isolated, he'll be tested again. His family and his friends will all be put under contact tracing or quarantine while that's sorted out. When we talk about testing large numbers of people, especially in a place like Singapore, where the prevalence of infection or the incidence of infection in the community is still very low, then we are going to have to deal with this problem of false positives and a lot of inconvenienced people.
The that definitely brings the point of trade-offs, right? Because no system is perfect. And ultimately, it's how happy are we with the level of intrusiveness and whether we can bear that. Bearing in mind that Singapore has plans to hold big high-stakes events like the Tennis Open in February and the World Economic Forum in May, those are high-stakes because they could pilot sensible ways to hold big MICE events. And it could go some way to maybe boost the Singapore economy, has reputational implications for us. So with that in mind, 5 months down the road, do you think the restrictions that we have today will hold? Do you think our level of tolerance will be lower until after we cleared those events?
I think I may be wrong that for these high-stake events, they will be held in much the same way as those green lanes or business travel, meaning that all the participants will be kind of walled away from the rest of the community. They'll have their own itineraries, their own arranged places to stay, so on and so forth, so as to minimize the chance that they will be able to spread the virus to the rest of the community. And I'm certain that they will be tested like daily with the antigen tests, for instance. I don't think there'll be a requirement that they be vaccinated before they come. That's obviously impossible. But I'm sure that these precautions will be set in place for big events or high-stakes events like these.
I'll ask David the same question, but then you've not answered my question, which is that local restrictions, would that hold, or do you think our tolerance level would go down? Now, of course, there will be special measures for this group of people who come for these events, and they'll be bubble wrapped, basically. But do you think that those events have a bearing on how Singapore approaches these other restrictions for the local community, for the local population?
If you think about them as being bubble wrapped away, then they actually don't impact how we deal with COVID-19 restrictions in the community, right? That's almost a separate issue. I think in 5 months' time, you depend on what's the situation around the world, what percentage of our population has been vaccinated, and other considerations like that.
But surely we can't get to a stage where our local cases go up because that would scare people. And you don't want to scare the visitors from coming here. So that would have a bearing?
I'm not certain that things will change that much if the current situation holds, right? Currently, we are seeing mostly imported cases, one or two community cases. If this trend holds, there's no need to slap on extra restrictions just so that people will come for the World Economic Forum or for the Tennis Open.
Maybe this is getting a little bit more at your question, which is that what difference does it make to the community that such events are able to occur? And I do worry, and again, this is, goes back to my conversation with my taxi driver, is that the sense that people are feeling as though things are kind of okay, and having these events might actually increase that sense of, you know, we're doing okay and we can kind of ease off. I think that we have to just be certain not to transmit that message that, yes, we're open for business, you know, yes, we're able to do these because we have these special bubbles that are put in place, but that that doesn't mean that the community should be less concerned, all other things being equal. So if the environment is such that our risk levels are about the same, we should continue to behave at the community level the same way, irrespective of whether we have the World Economic Forum in Singapore.
So then looking further ahead, because, you know, Minister Lawrence Wong actually did say at the Singapore Perspectives Forum that this pandemic will last for 4 to 5 years. Is that a worst case scenario, or do you think that's a likely realistic projection?
I think he made that projection based on the vaccination campaigns that's going around the rest of the world, where a lot of countries haven't even received any of the vaccines yet and will have difficulty rolling them out. But the long-term scenario most of us think will happen is that this virus will become endemic. It'll be like the influenza virus or measles or mumps that we just accept as part of the world we live in. There's almost no chance that this virus will disappear off the face of the earth.
And that will take the 4 to 5 years.
That may take any number of years, I don't know, but easily 2 to 3 years.
Vaccination rates in other countries was something that we chatted about before. Could you tell us why that matters to a country like Singapore?
That's probably a really important point to raise, is that when you look at the vaccination programs that are in place, that the high-income countries are vaccinating or starting to vaccinate, the low-income countries, low- and middle-income countries are not, some have not even started or don't even have clear plans. The problem is we've couched this as, oh, is it a fairness issue? Are we being fair to the countries that don't have access to vaccines? We want to be altruistic. We should make sure that we have vaccinations available for those countries. And I think that that is an issue. We have to deal with the fact that we are responsible for each other. But we also are responsible for ourselves and not having other countries in which the virus is circulating means that the virus has an opportunity to mutate. And if it has an opportunity to mutate...
Like in the UK.
Like in the UK, but in any number of countries that have very low vaccination rates, we see almost no vaccination going on in Africa, for example. The opportunity for mutation occurs, and then that bounces back to the high-income countries. So not only is it good to do because we're altruistic, it's good to do because it's good for us to help promote vaccinations internationally because it makes us safer.
So when Singapore sees half of its imported cases coming from India and Indonesia, is that your sense that we should be paying attention to the developments in those two countries in particular?
We owe it to them and we owe it to ourselves to take an interest in their vaccination programs.
If this is our new normal, do you see these restrictions currently in place will be retained over the next 4 to 5 years?
If the situation improves, they will ease, but they won't completely disappear. I don't believe we'll be able to travel freely between countries like we did pre-COVID. We may have to end up wearing masks all the time for the next few years. They may ease the number of people coming together, depending on the situation in the community, but that's about it, probably.
So just, I guess, going back to the start of our conversation about Chinese New Year, I was reading through some of the comments that our Facebook followers left for us about how they would deal with Chinese New Year. And some of the comments were really interesting. Could you guess how people were taking it?
I suppose you ranged the gamut from being resigned to being upset.
Yeah, I was kind of imagining that you would have a mix of people who are very, you know, upset with people who are not taking the social distancing seriously, but you'd have a significant number of people who were basically very upset that this is a really important time of year and this is not the time for us to restrain ourselves, that we need to be with family, we need to go from house to house, and this is not fair. So I'm kind of guessing you got a split sample there.
So I can't speak for people who don't comment, but for those who did, it's interesting because it seems like they're adapting quite well. So for example, Matt Khan said she's happy with less visitors. Can we implement this every Chinese New Year? I think it's more of the fatigue there. And Jillian Wong, who said she's sticking to video greetings given the number of senior citizens she has in her family. Sounds like we're learning how to make do with our new normal.
Yeah.
Just rounding off this podcast, in your view as infectious disease experts, how can festivities like Chinese New Year and, you know, even more editions of Christmas, Hari Raya, Deepavali be celebrated in a way that's meaningful, given also that we know this heightened vigilance state will probably stay for the next, I guess, 4 to 5 years?
The most important thing is that we recognize what it is what we value about these holidays or about these events. For the most part, what we value is the connection that we have between ourselves and amongst ourselves. And I think that if we can find ways of reflecting that and transmitting that to each other. So how can we let people know during Chinese New Year that they're our family, that we care about them, that our elders, how they are respected and cared for, even though we can't visit them as readily? Finding ways to do that is really key. And whatever you can do, if you can use technology, if you can drop things off at the house, whatever you can do, I mean, to make sure that you let that person know that you care about them.
I agree with David. You know, we had a quiet Hari Raya, with a quiet Bisang Day, a quiet Christmas. It's, in a perverse way, it's almost equitable to have a quiet Chinese New Year this time around.
It's only fair. And there you have it from the experts on the fresh COVID-19 curbs and what will be a very different Chinese New Year and a couple of years ahead. But kudos to our listeners for taking it so well. The team who made this Heart of the Matter episode possible, Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Low, our research writer. This podcast was recorded with Sennheiser. You can find previous episodes on the CNA website, app, Me Listen, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. And I'm Lin Tzu Ling, signing off until we meet again next week.